All right, we can begin. Right, we're set. Okay, Yashikaya. Okay, but remember, I have to sit with you after class a number of matters. Nothing that you can't handle. Okay? I hope it's not too sharp that, you know, I'm saying, giving him a little bit of a shtuch that he's in chutz la'aretz, but what can I do? We all feel that way, what we could do with so many good Jews here. Wow. All right, anyway, today is a very interesting lecture. I'm going to, a little bit more than history, a little bit insight, but all part of the Torah history of the period. Today, to begin with, is Monday, the 26th of November, 2018. And I send special regards to the students in front of me, the students listening across the world, and to Vic Snow, Kishmo Einohu, because he's in Florida right now, where I doubt if there'll be snow. And just filling in what we spoke about, the story of Peter Bergson is an amazing story, actually, because here's a Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva boy, gets caught up with the right wing, gets caught up with Beitar, ultimately Chaver Knesset, and doesn't really find his place in Israel. See, that's sad. At times, people, when they have ideas, it's hard to adjust to the reality. Can anyone give me another example? A very sad example that whenever I mention it, it breaks my heart. Ida Nudel. If you follow the story with Ida Nudel, here's the lady who was the symbol of the revolt against the communist empire by the Jews. And when she came to Israel, she was never happy. She suffered here. Why did she suffer? You're living in a country where you have Jews that earn a salary from the state of Israel who work 24/7 to wipe Israel off the map. I need not tell you what's going on now with the hotels. That's all Jews started that. Got them to stop Jews here from Israel. And Ida Nudel could never make a peace with it. She was overwhelmed that in the state of Israel, and they get publicity too, even on the news, you hear what happened, and then they quote Tzipi Livni as if she's running the country for 5 minutes of shtuyot on the news. And anyone listening, it hurts, absolutely. And that's an excellent example of someone who came, and you remember were you here when she came? Of course, remember the welcome. Right, hundreds of thousands went out, and what it meant, Ida Nudel, the symbol she was, and she should live and be well. But, all right, some of us, we've made our peace. I'm living here 50 years. I can't say I'm overjoyed with everything, but Baruch Hashem, we got to work, we have to make it better. So, this Peter Bergson, but Ben Hecht, this is amazing how he got hold of such a famous American, a totally assimilated American from the Lower East Side. Then his parents moved way out of in the middle of Illinois, had a business, and at the age of 16 he runs away to Chicago. And he never went back from graduated high school and never went to college, and went on immediately making a living, a reporter, writing, doing. Now, I only want to make one addendum to what I said last week. I said last week he was married to a Goya. That's correct. That's his first marriage. But his second marriage already married a Jewish woman, and she came back with him, belayed for nefesh. Later, when they became so active, and you gotta, I still remember the period as a kid, the way people spoke about Ben Hecht and the play he wrote, We Will Never Die. Remember, that was put on during World War II. Eleanor Roosevelt attended one of the performances, and his wife went along with him 100%. They later bought a boat for the Irgun to bring Ma'apilim from Europe. They were caught by the British. They were sent to Cyprus, or interned, I might be wrong, but they were interned by the British. But that boat became the flagship of the Israeli Navy when it first began. Where did they get it? It was a big boat. That was the flagship of the Israeli Navy, and it was named in honor of Benna, his wife. It's an amazing story, and worthy of a lot more than what I've said, but it's an amazing story. And that brings about the March on Washington. Before I get involved with the March on Washington, I just want to mention a student wrote to me, Baruch Kohane, and he's quoting, he hasn't realized it, he's quoting what I lectured in great depth quite a few years ago, if you recall, with the RJJ venture. And this is a theory. I don't know whether it can actually be proven. I don't know whether there are documents that support it. But when we deal with the tremendous question, why were the Japanese so good to the Jews? After all, the Japanese had formed an alliance with the Nazis. And here they have Jews in Japan, and ultimately they moved them on to Shanghai, and no one died at Japanese hands. There were people that died in Shanghai from disease, from illness. The sanitary conditions weren't the greatest. It was very crowded. But the hands of the Japanese have no Jewish blood on them. So I explained last week the story with the Rav Shatskis and the Amshon of a Rebbe, and why do the Nazis hate you, and what they answered. And there's no history in Japan and in China. They never had Jews. There's no history of any anti-Semitism. Even today, if you read the news about communist China, they opened up a branch of the Technion there. Now they opened up a branch of the Haifa University in China. You know what that means, a branch? They gave the Technion something, do you remember the exact sum? It was like $130+ million to use their name. And they bring faculty over. My grandson, I have grandchildren, have quite a few grandchildren in the Technion. So they tell me they take faculty and bring them to China for half a year. And they pay the Technion, now Haifa University. So there's no history of anti-Semitism. But there's more to it with Japan. And this may be, it's a theory, or it may be absolutely true. But I spoke about this. I wrote back to the person who wrote to me that I'll mention it in class, because I mentioned it years ago. You see, when the German Jews came to America, they did very well in banking. And among the German Jews, there was one person in particular, Jacob Schiff. I trust you've heard the name. Those of us who grew up in New York, his daughter, Dorothy Schiff, was the owner and publisher of the New York Post. When we were growing up as kids, Dorothy Schiff, she was the daughter of Jacob Schiff. Now, Jacob Schiff was a very interesting individual. He grew up on the lap of Rav Simsonfeld here. She grew up in Frankfurt. He grew up Torim Derech Eretz. He came to America. He became president of Temple Emanuel, the bastion of Reform Judaism. But say what you want about Jacob Schiff, he always remained a hybrid. Call him Schatnitz, call him Kleim. I can give you a simple example. He was Shomer Shabbos. He benched after every meal. When you talk about the davening with Talit and Tefillin, he davened every day. That's the famous story, which is not anecdotal, it's true, that one time on a weekday morning, they come to the base Medrash HaGadla on Norfolk Street, Lower East Side, and they see a beautiful carriage outside, like today you would see, a famous car, a Rolls Royce. You would see a Rolls Royce parked outside the shul, a carriage with horses and a coachman. And they go into the shul, and there's Mr. Jacob Schiff davening with talis and tefillin. So they said to him, Mr. Schiff, you had to come all the way down to the east side. You're the president of Temple Emanuel, Fifth Avenue. And Jacob Schiff says, I have yahrzeit for my mother today. Can I hold the yahrzeit for my mother in Temple Emanuel, the Reformed Temple? He was always a hybrid, but he had tremendous Jewish feeling. Because of him, he got the others involved. There was Warburg, there were other bankers, very wealthy. The German Jews conquered America in that sense. all the department stores, the Bambergers, Macy's, Klein's, any department store you Gimbel's, any department store you'll mention, it goes back to German Jews who succeeded. So now the Russo-Japanese War broke out in 1905. Japan needed to borrow money to field an army, to get armament, to get equipment. Who was willing to lend money to Japan? It was viewed as a primitive country. Jacob Schiff put together a consortium of bankers and they lent Japan what you would call today billions of dollars. It seems that there were people in the Japanese hierarchy, because we're talking 1940 is not that long after 1905. It's 35 years, all right? 35 years is not the 100 years ago. And they remembered how good the Jews were to them. Why was Jacob Schiff so good to them? Because he was furious at Russia for the way they treated the Jews. There was pogrom after pogrom after pogrom. And with that in mind, he was happy to lend them the money and that they should have the ability to take on the Russians. And you know that they did set the whole world. Ultimately, what happens as a result of the Russo-Japanese War, it brings about the Russian Revolution, it brings about the fall of the Tsar, it brings about the fall of anti-Semitism. Say what you want about the Communist Revolution, in certainly the first 20 years, there was almost no anti-Semitism whatsoever. Lenin, it turns out now, we found out that Lenin had one grandparent who was Jewish. Not a mother, it was a father. So Lenin was not Jewish, but he had Jewish blood in him. And in the mid-20s, when Lenin was ill, and Lenin was viewed as a god, again, it's hard for you to understand this. We don't view Netanyahu as a god. Certainly Clinton is not viewed as a god. I need not tell you what's going on in America. Lenin was viewed as a god. And they asked him to record. He made, I think it was 6 different recordings on 6 different aspects of life. Economics and social and the concept of the worker. And the 6th recording was on anti-Semitism. What's fascinating is many years later, they redid these recordings. Only one was left out, the one against anti-Semitism. You follow? So that is Lenin and anti-Semitism. And yes, Jacob Schiff gave the Japanese all the money they needed, beat the hell out of the Russians. I hate them because they don't treat our Jewish people. They don't treat my brethren properly. Okay. That's point number one. Now I want to come back to the March on Washington. And I want to bring my Rebbe into the classroom. My Rebbe is always in the classroom, but now I want to bring him in word by word. It was a great privilege. Dov, did you study with the Rav?
No.
Okay, but you know, even if you studied with the Rav in the 70s, it was a different era already. I had the privilege when I eulogized, Charlie, this you'll appreciate, Lo Aleinu, when I eulogized David Applebaum. So I made a very interesting point that David Applebaum and I shared the same concept. We both became Talmidim of our Rebbeim at the pinnacle of their lives of teaching. I was like the 15th year into Rav Soloveitchik's teaching in YU, and David Applebaum picked up Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, his younger brother, exactly like the 15th year into Rav Aaron's being a Rebbe. Mamish, the 15th year, we reached them at their strength before illness, when they were who they really were. You got to remember, when someone grows older, he doesn't have the energy to take on the world. You ride with the waves. I can tell you, privileged conversation. I hope the recorder won't pick it up, but this is something you'll never forget. It's privileged material. It's not something anyone knows. In the 70s, the Rav's son, my classmate, who's a Gaon Adir in his own right, but he's gone into Chochmat Yisrael, but what he's published, very few since Matan Torah can equal Chaim in knowledge. He's something very special. So Chaim, I have to give all the credit in the world, went back to the States. He was living here. He was a professor at Hebrew U. But when his father took ill in the 70s, the Rav's father is gone. Chaim's two sisters are married. They have family. You know, you get involved. It's when if I want to call one of my daughters or one of my grandchildren, so my wife will always say, don't bother them, don't bother them. They're busy. And it's true. And thank God I'm healthy. I don't need help. But it's a sad thought that you can have so many children and so many grandchildren, so many great-grandchildren, but everyone is caught up in their own world. So Chaim is not married. He went back to the States to take care of his father, slept in the same room with his father, went to the shirim with his father. If you saw the documentary on the Rebbe, was published to bring into the world, The Lonely Man of Faith, you'll see people interviewed or telling stories about their interaction with Chaim in the classroom when he's his father's Talmud again in the 70s. So Chaim was upset. If you know what went on in YU, there was a swing to the right. It began already in the 60s, into the 70s, the 80s, a marked swing to the right, which still is part of the YU scene until today. And I don't want to, it's now not time to discuss it. That's a different question altogether. But students in this very classroom got hold of me about 10 years ago and started punching me like a punching bag. Rebbe, why did you leave America? You stayed in America. Why you would be different? And I said to them, you guys are so dumb. It's unbelievable. If I would have stayed in America, I would be like everyone else. I would have swung to the right too. You go to Israel and you're exposed to a whole different world and you mature. Avira Diara, what Israel did for me, and did Charlie, you'll agree with me too, what it did for you, Jack, what it did for you. You can't compare. Yeah. Can't compare to Chutz Laretz. So Chaim was upset, and he says to his father, and I was told this by ear witnesses, Dad, why don't you give some classes like you used to give in the 50s in Bernard Revel Graduate School? They're all going right wing. No one understands the total picture. It's your fault, he says to his father. Give some classes in philosophy and let them understand what Yiddishkeit is about. And the Rav says to his son, you're right, but I don't have the kayach, I don't have the energy. And you see, that's something with age. You're older. I know how much less strength I have at my age than I had 30, 40 years ago. You understand? That's life. That's the reality of life. That's the way God made the world. So I don't know if I have the story entirely right. I have to be very careful when I say something because someone will play it and maybe I'm making an emendation. But the gist of the story is absolutely correct. So I had the privilege of the Rav when he was at his prime. And you caught him in the shir when it was Kulo, Gemara, Shas, Paiskim, Reb Chaim. You caught him down in Moria when he gave his shir once a week, where already there was much more Gada, and then he spoke on the Pasher of the week. You caught him Saturday night in Boston when Yitz Rubin used to go crazy with joy. He used to write every word down that the Rav said, where he used the Pasher as a basis. But he could go into philosophy, he could just go into literature. He opened the Wadan Sunday morning. You had the Chevrah Shas in Boston, which again was on a different level. It wasn't like the Shir in New York. And you caught the Rav RCA convention. Oh, the world's the Yahrzeit Shir, the Tshuva Drasha. So the Rav, unbelievable the impact he had. And Kolzman, that he was active the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, he was the determining key in YU. In the 70s already, age and ill health. By the 80s, others were filling in the void. Now, I want to come back to what I said a minute ago. The world, the communist world, viewed Lenin as a Getchka. And the time I spent in communist Russia, the 10 years I was heavily involved with communist Russia, three trips to communist Russia, I got to understand what the world is about. And you see, most people don't think. We're sitting in a class and we're thinking and we're going deep. Most people, if they were to announce now, 9:30 in the morning, we're setting up a hot dog stand with tremendous, delicious American beef hot dogs with sauerkraut and mustard and baked beans, most people would run out, go to the hot dog stand. It's only the few and far between who would say, no, learning and hearing a good shiur, a good lecture, gaining insight is more important than some beef hot dogs. It's few and far between. The masses are different. The masses tend to love a strong leader. Communism was able to succeed because Lenin became an overwhelmingly strong leader. Stalin, could you believe it that in Israel there were kibbutzim, and this is a fact, this is not anecdotal, kibbutzim that had pictures of Stalin in the dining room. And that already was at a time that he hated the Jews, that he wanted, this is, we're talking the late 40s, early 50s, the Shomatzir kibbutzim, Mapam. People looked, when Stalin died, when Lenin died, people cried. It was mass mourning. Who were they? In the United States of America, we had practically that same experience with President Roosevelt. FDR, I grew up in a home, and remember, my parents were born in Harlem. My parents were as American as apple pie, blueberry pie, pumpkin pie on Halloween, or pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving Day. Call it whatever you wish. I grew up a big picture of Roosevelt. People worshipped him. The Jews worshipped him. And it was a war, psychologically, much has been written about this, but psychologically, at a time of war, you need a strong leader. Look at Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, the British were practically wiped off the map. And he spoke, and he gave them courage. Roosevelt was looked up to 10 times more even than Winston Churchill. He was re-elected 4 times. He was indefeatable. Afterwards, they changed the law in America that you can only serve 2 terms. Now, if all this is true, and the Jews literally worshipped Roosevelt, I remember in 1944, I write about this in Washington, and I bididi haviyuvdet. I don't have to tell stories. I was there. I was part of it. So Roosevelt was campaigning for his 4th term. It was a minor campaign, because he was a shoo, and everyone knew that. But still, he had to show he's campaigning. So on a Shabbos, he came through the Bronx. His entourage visited New York, and they went through the Bronx. So Roosevelt was told that his people arranging it, they're going to go through this neighborhood, that neighborhood, and then they're going to go through the East Bronx, and they're going to come up on Shabbos morning, Washington Avenue. Why are they going to come up Washington Avenue? Because Washington Avenue in the East Bronx, further down, I grew up a little bit further up, about 4 blocks away, 5 blocks away from what I'm describing. But on Washington Avenue, for about 7, 8 blocks, there probably were 15 different shuls. Big, small, shtiblach. And they want Roosevelt to reach out to the Jews. The Jews heard that Roosevelt is coming for the first time. Did you ever hear Torah Jews should get together and be friends? What's going on now with Aguder and Degel HaTorah? And it reached America. I mean, I'm now getting reports from America. It's frightening. It's kedai to go online and listen to Rav Perlow, the Novominska Rebbe, or Rav, who's Rav, it should be Novominska Rav, who's the head of Aguda, the president of Aguda, speaking Saturday night, the other night. But very sad. Do you know that all the shuls in the Bronx got together and we built an Erev? I can never forget it. The first time in my life I saw an Erev on Washington Avenue. Why did they build an Erev? Because the president, it was arranged, he would come at 11 o'clock approximately, if I recall. All the shuls finished davening by 11 o'clock. Everyone came out, and they brought out the Sifrei Torah for the president to kiss. Could you imagine? And there were pictures the next day in the Daily News, in the Daily Mirror, in the Herald Tribune. These were the daily papers. You didn't have TV then, you didn't have the computer. Everyone lived on newspapers. Today, a newspaper is a vanishing commodity, like stores are disappearing. You understand the whole world is changing, and this is inevitable, because even the stores are encouraging, if you don't know, on Black Friday, they're encouraging you to order online. I said to Malka, they're undermining themselves, because once a person, they want to, the rush scenes on the malls were so great, order online. Well, once you start ordering online, you start ordering online all the time. Who needs stores? The only stores that will survive, if you want to invest money, open up a food store. Food, people have to eat. Basically, you have to, even that you can order online, but still, there's a need to touch it, to look at it, to smell it. So, what they did with Roosevelt, they built the Nehru, they took out the Sifrei Torah. Wow. Now let me ask a simple question. Here they have the March on Washington. Hundreds of rabbis, millions of Jews have been killed already. Thousands are being killed daily. And Roosevelt doesn't even come out to speak with them. And I'll give you all the sources. We now have all the memoir literature of people who participated. He asked his Jewish advisors. And the Jewish advisors told him, these are weeds from Europe. They're worthless, these people. They're disappearing. These aren't the future American Jews. Not worth your talking to them. Not worth your bothering with them. And these very Jews worshipped Roosevelt. These rabbis represented synagogues where all they spoke about, Roosevelt, victory, the four freedoms, nothing to fear but fear itself, Russia, Roosevelt's famous statements. And look at the way he reacted. And looking at what happened on that day of the march, you would reach a conclusion, it was a total failure. And I want to quote to you from a work, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 2, beginning on page 156. And this is a lecture the Rav gave to the Rabbinical Council of America in 1977. All the details are here. And the Rav speaks about this very relationship. And what I'm about to quote to you is not Rekefet. This is word by word the Rav. I recorded it from tapes. Here I didn't have to translate because the original lecture was in English. Many times I record what the Rav said, but it's my translation from the Yiddish. And this is the Rav speaking. We may have trust in man, confidence in him, but we may not have faith in him. Faith connotes absoluteness, and no man is worthy of absolute faith. The concept of faith is only applicable to God. And now he talks about 1943, the march. I was young at the time, but I felt that we were wrong in our relationship to a certain person. Our relationship to President Roosevelt bordered on idolatry. Had it not been an idolatrous relationship, we should have saved hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Jews from the concentration camps and the crematoria. The fact is that we did not exert any pressure. The State Department would call in the American Jewish leaders and tell them not to circulate the stories about the extermination of the Jews from the crematoria. The State Department claimed that these stories would have hampered the war effort. I do not understand why this was so, Yet the Jewish leaders accepted it. And wow, this is so powerful. Could you imagine? This is the Rav speaking. And this, what I'm about to quote now, is perhaps one of the most famous public statements he ever made. I trust you've heard it quoted before, but this is word by word the Rav. A layman once suggested to me that we should include another Al Chet in our Yom Kippur confessional, quote, "For the sins we have committed in being unresponsive to the cries of our brethren in Europe who were brutally slaughtered," end quote. On Yom Kippur, how many Al Chets do we say? Right or wrong? Endless Al Chets. Have to add another one. Al Chet Shechatanu, I'll tell you how the Rav phrased it in Hebrew. Al Chet Shechatanu Fanecha Sheshamanu with Kol Tzakat Achenu V'lo Asinu Dai V'lo Asinu Maspek. Lenny, do you say an Al Chet like that? That's what the Rav proposed. But he was quite right. I am not blaming anybody. I am blaming myself. Why didn't I act like Mordechai when he heard the news about the evil decree issued by Haman and Achashverosh? Why didn't I, and the Rav now quotes the Pasuk in Esther, go out into the center of the city and shout bitterly and loudly? Why didn't I shout, yell and cry? Why didn't I tear my clothes like Mordechai? Why didn't I awaken the Jewish leaders? I'm not blaming anybody. This was the punishment for being idol worshippers. Our faith in Roosevelt bordered on idolatry. And this is a very insightful, powerful statement. 41, 42, how the president twisted the leaders of the Jewish community around his fingers. And when the march took place in Washington, the problem was there was not one prominent Reform rabbi. There was not one prominent Jewish statesman. Everyone was silenced by Roosevelt. And these few hundred rabbis with beards, black clothes, it was unheard of in America then. Today, anyone walks around, a beard, payas, a shtreimel, nothing is unheard of. Everything is in the mainstream today. But in 43, and the masses didn't know how to yell and shout and scream, and Roosevelt was able to get away with it. He did not receive the delegation. Let me go a step further, and let me quote to you from page 157. And if you look at my footnote, you'll see I cite the Boston Rebbetzin as well. She wrote a memoir. The Boston Rebbetzin, remember, it was published by Masora, that's a subsidiary of Art Scroll, by Rachel Horowitz. You've all heard of the Boston Rebbe, Yitzchak Levi Horowitz, Eichat Tzadik Levracha. This was his Rebbetzin. And she wrote a memoir where she essentially says exactly what the Rav says. I'm quoting here from a lecture he gave at Yeshiva University, 1980, on Pashat Shmot. During the Holocaust years, American Jews were very indifferent. At least they acted as if they were indifferent. They were afraid of Roosevelt and did not act properly. American Jews apparently did not identify with their brethren in Auschwitz and Treblinka. Had they felt identity with these people, they would have yelled, shouted, and complained. When the Agudas HaRabbanim organized the march on Washington, Roosevelt refused to see them. It was the day before Erev Yom Kippur, and yet Roosevelt refused to see them. Nothing helped. Roosevelt let Henry Wallace, who was then the vice president, receive the delegation. The Jewish people just did not react to the event. As a matter of fact, many Particularly, the Jewish press enjoyed the spectacle. Remember, what we're talking about here is a totally assimilated Jewish press, like the New York Times, laughing at these rabbis who came to Washington a day or two before Yom Kippur, and Roosevelt wouldn't see them. He sent Wallace. 500 rabbis went to Washington. These rabbanim sent a delegation consisting of 5 rabbis to meet with the president. But he did not receive them. And you see the pain by which the Rub is speaking. And this event played a very big role in the Rub's life. I can quote him at other times as well when he related to it. There is no question in my mind that this was the Makkah B'Patish. You know what Makkah B'Patish means, gentlemen? This was the final hammer blow. It's Lashon of Hilchot Shabbat. The final hammer blow that pushed the Rav away from Agudat Yisrael into the Mizrahi camp. And I have to tell you, the Boston Rebbetzin makes a very similar point. And the Boston Rebbe, as much as he was publicly identified with Agudat Yisrael, you should know he was very close to the Mizrahi. And in his old age, when he saw what Agudat Yisrael was capable of, Gush Katif and the land they gave up and what they did, he was ready to publicly come out against them. The only reason he held back was his health. I know this from inside, his health. Later, when he died from his final illness at that time, his son, Reb Naftali, came to a meeting with the Moetzei Gedolei HaTorah thinking he would succeed his father, and he was very uncourteously extorted out the door. Follow me? They knew already what seeds his father had planted in him, and the Moetzei Gedolei HaTorah, with their viewpoint and what we're suffering today, we can go on and on, but let's go back to 1943. So this event plays a key role, and underline one word when you describe the Rav before 43 and the Rav after 43. There's one word you have to add to your description of to the Rav: activism. Underline it. I'm proud to say that a guy named Rakefet was the first one to say this. If you listen to the 6 tapes that were recorded for the OU, the Rav and Religious Zionism, they're all on YU Torah, but go and find something in YU Torah. It's not indexed. Maybe someone is listening and is willing to put up a few million dollars to hire 5 people to listen to the Sheyurim and index them. It would be a tremendous help to some people who seek out this type of point of view, Rakefet's thinking. Okay, from Zayin Gesund, I throw out seeds which Halavai should blossom. But Rabbi Lichtenstein said the same thing a few years later in a talk he gave in the Gush. Because everyone raises this question, so much ink has been spilled on it. Even now, Rabbi J.J. Schachter is giving a course and he's speaking on it on one of the topics. How did the Rav leave Agudat Yisrael and go on to become a Mizrahiite? And this is a key factor. All right, but let me go further. What did we say last week? Who was there? Who attended? Who came to the march? And here it's very interesting. If you recall last week we spoke about there was an alliance between Peter Berkson, known as Hillel Cook originally, and the Agudas HaRabbanim. And these were two elements that the establishment laughed at. Peter Berkson represented the right wing. The right wing until today, the establishment laughs at you. Only the left knows how to do everything, and only they have divine insight, and only they are totally right. And anyone right wing is wrong. Berkson, we're talking the Eitzel, the Lechi, the Jabotinsky people, the Beitar, and Peter Berkson. We spoke about him last week. You have to fill in the lecture. He was the nephew of Avraham Yitzchak Kohen Cook. His original name is Hillel Cook, but when he worked in America, he took the name Peter Berkson. 2 theories why. One is very simple: to be more cultured, more Anglo-sized. Peter Berkson. The other reason is not to embarrass his father, his grandfather, his uncle, because he was no longer that religious, and he didn't want to be associated with the name Cook. But he and Rav Lazer Silva hit it off, and as we spoke about last week, he's the one who returned Ben Hecht to Jewish identity. And Ben Hecht, who was so famous at the time, you couldn't find a more famous playwright, a more famous newspaper man, a more famous Jew, a more famous, totally integrated, assimilated Jew, and he, Hillel Cook, brings him back to Jewish identity, and they play a tremendous role. Now, as we ended off last week's shiur, the greatest rabbinic figure on the American scene at the time, outside of Rav Lazer Silva, the greatest Rosh Yeshiva, nascent Rosh Yeshiva, about to become a famous Rosh Yeshiva in America, Rav Aaron Cutler, did not participate in the rally. A lot of eyebrows have been raised about that, but knowing Rav Aaron's thinking and where he was coming from and where he was going, ultimately, we can understand Rav Aaron, he doesn't want to associate with Bergson, and he doesn't want to associate with Hecht, and he doesn't want to associate with people who are publicly refuting and contradicting the President of the United States, the State Department. You found that in the 80s and the 90s, and Rav Shach time and again took the same point of view. You're not allowed to rebel against the nations of the world. You're not allowed to mock them. You're not allowed to differ with them. So Rav Aaron didn't participate. But who did participate? And here I'm quoting from an entry that summarizes Hillel Cook or Peter Bergson's life. And among the participants, of course, the most famous rabbi was Rav Lazer Silva, the Agudas HaRabbanim. Rav Moshe Feinstein participated. So you see, and Rav Moshe again, Dov, it's not Rav Moshe of today. Today when I mention Rav Moshe, you have to stand up, right or wrong. Rav Moshe. Yeah, Rav Moshe then was a Rosh Yeshiva, a Rebbe, a Rav on the east side, lower east side. He wasn't yet Rav Moshe, but he participated. See, unlike Rav Aaron Cutler, he was there. The Biyana Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Shlomo Friedman, the Biyana Rebbe was the most famous Rebbe in the United States. The only one who was more famous but could not be active due to ill health was the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe by 1943. But the Biyana Rebbe already was in America from the 1920s on. So he participated. That's very... Rav Avram Kalmanovich, he was the president of Mir, remember, and he wound up in America raising funds for Mir. He was a Yudapayish Rav, and he participated. He was an activist. He has the great schut that he fainted and cried on Morgenthau's desk. Remember we spoke about Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, and he brought Henry Morgenthau, who was an assimilated German Jew, he brought him back to Jewish feeling. And Morgenthau becomes very important in the saga that will follow this. So there's another participant, Rabbi Naftali Kalbach. Who is Rabbi Naftali Kalbach? That Shlomo's father, the dancing Rebbe. Shlomo Kalbach was in short pants at the time. He was a young kid. But his father already was a Rav on the Upper West Side. He participated. Rabbi Charles Kahana. Who was Rabbi Charles Kahana? Father of? No, Meir Kahana. Absolutely. Rav Yecheskel Kahana Del. I knew him, Rabbi Charles Kahana. Charlie. He participated. Your name, Charles. Now, perhaps the only conservative rabbi, and I'll qualify it in a second, who participated, was Arthur Hertzberg, along with his father, Rabbi Tzvi Elimelech Hertzberg of Baltimore. And here you have to know, the Hertzberg family, they come from Hasidic stock. And his father was a bit of a Hasidic Rebbe, if I'm not mistaken, in Baltimore. Arthur went on to study at yeshiva, study at the seminary. He held a very large conservative congregation. He was the rabbi in New Jersey, Arthur Hertzberg. But in his personal life, he always was Shema Torah Mitzvah 100%. You have to remember, the conservative temples then, their compromise was the mixed seating. Outside of the mixed seating, everything else, you can go into a conservative temple, the prayer book was Orthodox, the davening was Orthodox, the Kriyat Hatzeirah. I still remember standing in a conservative temple in Cherry Hill. The rabbi was a father, was a first cousin to Meir Kahana. His name was Kahana, Shlomo Kahana. And I remember I taught his children, wonderful children. They all turned out great. And he's in this big conservative temple, rabbi there many, many decades. And I remember a balabas is coming in. He's very unhappy with the conservative temple he was a member of. And he's looking for a conservative temple where they won't give the women aliyot. You follow? And I can see this guy, his attitude towards women. Idiot, if you're sitting mixed, why can't they have aliyot? Why can't they lay in the Torah? Why can't they, if you're sitting men and women together, so then you're saying men and women are equal. But this guy, is the word misogynist, is that the right word? What word did you see? His enmity towards women. I remember standing there in the shul with the rabbi. I was there, a friend of mine who lived in the neighborhood, a medical doctor, but older than you. You would know Miles Terz, an early graduate of Einstein. But Hertzberg was the only formal conservative rabbi who participated. Now, in the biography of Peter Berkson, so they describe the people who were Jewish and advised the president, this is a quote, what he was told, including Dr. Stephen Weiss, the famous Reform rabbi, said to him, Mr. President, quote, you wouldn't want to be associated with these people. And that was the attitude. One of the Jewish newspapers that had a more positive Jewish attitude had an editorial with a similar delegation of 500 Catholic priests have been treated like this, followed with a big question mark. So this was the situation, this is what happened, this was the frustration, this was the heartache, this was the rub, and the rub's comment is very important. We do not have the right to worship anyone. It is idolatrous. A man is only a man. We have some good leaders, wonderful leaders. And I can tell you, in the history of the State of Israel, we talk about Ben-Gurion. Had Ben-Gurion not been Prime Minister, there would have never been a State of Israel, because he had the guts to declare the state against the will of the American State Department. Just think. On the other hand, do we worship Ben-Gurion? Ben-Gurion allowed all the kids who came in from Morocco and Yemen, they snipped off their payas. They took chickens and hacked them with a hatchet, with a hammer. We don't need a shaykhir here. And look what's happening there. Look what's coming out now in public. Malka, we read some of the articles, the testimony. My wife shakes. I tell her, well, there's nothing to shake. Who are you going to execute? There's no one to take the trial. They took children away from their parents and gave them up for adoption. Some of them wound up in America. Who knows if some of you don't descend from Yemenite children who were taken away at the age of 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, taken away from their parents. They have two men. These are facts. I'm not making it up. And no one can accuse me of not being a Zionist. They'll say, oh, anti-Zionist propaganda. Halavai would be anti-Zionist propaganda. These are facts. It's breaking out now. You have no idea. There were Yemenite leaders that yelled and shouted. They persecuted them. Rabbi Meshulam died young. He yelled. You take Menachem Begin. Right. Menachem Begin had a lot of good treats. Do you recognize this? Okay.
We get you know.
No. I can refill it. What's the problem? Menachem Begin had a lot of good traits. Baruch Ato Adonai Olam Ha'olam She'akol Nehiyah Bedvaro. Menachem Begin had a lot of good traits. But I always get upset when people praise him and sing his prayer, right? He was honest, self-sacrificing. He didn't plead for fancy cigars and champagne like some other prime ministers we know. Correct. I don't worship him, and I'll tell you why. I always say about Menachem Begin, an inverted Murano. People look at me. What do you mean an inverted Murano? What's a Murano? Murano was a guy on the outside, a Jew on the inside. Menachem Begin was the most Jewish prime minister we had on the outside. On the inside, I strongly question where his commitment was. Rakefet, how do you know this? I'll give you the Rakefet test. You want to know if someone really cares about Yiddishkeit? What type of chinuch did they give their son? Shimi, where did your parents send you to school?
Dad.
Where?
Dad.
I can't hear.
Dad.
Give me it a real name.
Denver,
I know.
Denver Academy of Torah.
I should know that. Dad. Denver Academy of Torah. Your parents paid a fortune tuition. Where'd they send you to high school? Spelled it out.
Bergen
County, all the way at the other end of the United States, paid a fortune. Where are you sitting now? The only thing that you're getting free of charge is this class. Right or wrong? Rafi, where did you go to school?
Frisch School.
Did you know Mr. Frisch? My wife did. It's a Bronx family. They made their money, had a paint factory, I think in Cuba, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Parents paid tuition, whatnot. Where did Begin's children go to school? Chinuch Mamlachti, not Chinuch Mamlachti Dati. Okay? Show me one child who's a total Shoma Torah mitzvah. Follow? I don't worship anyone. Ben Gurion had good points, had problems, in my humble opinion. Menachem Begin, fabulous good points, but some problems. An inverted Murano, Jew on the outside, but on the inside, Shas, Torah, Poskim, commitment, surrender. I just saw someone rip the hell out of Netanyahu. Oh, I know, in Mishpacha magazine, they interviewed Yitzchak Herzog. And Yitzchak Herzog says, I'm frimmer than Netanyahu. He's chiloni. What, when, how come the world doesn't realize I go to Shul Shabbos? Big deal. Where are your kids? What kind of chinuch are they getting? Menachem Binyamin Netanyahu, three children. A girl from his first marriage and two boys from his third marriage. Two out of the three children are Shomer Torah and Mitzvah. His daughter is married to my student from this very kollel. Rafi is doing something right. Do I worship him? No. Well, this good. And what has to be improved? The Rav's point is very important. Now, however, let the truth ring out. Baruch Hashem, not everyone is an anti-Semite, and not every non-Jew has no emotion and no feeling. And one of the people who did receive them was Senator William Barber, spelled B-A-R-B-O-U-R. And this Senator Barber was very moved by the rabbis. He knew what was happening. He knew the facts. And he was one of a number of people, and I don't want to leave out Henry Morgenthau, who became very involved, very moved by the Jews. We have to do something. It's 43. There's no hope. Every day that goes by, more and more are being killed. Ultimately, this march and the public impression it created by those who cared, it gave birth to a number of conferences to solve the problem. Some of these conferences achieved nothing, but ultimately the United States organized a committee that went on to save thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Jews, particularly in Hungary, and we'll come to it in a moment with a little bit more detail. Coming back to the march, on a personal level, I want to tell you that I have a lot of nachat. Some of you are familiar with my seventh book, Washington. The way Washington begins is my best piece of writing ever. If I had to start a new career, the rabbinate teaching is one. I could be a dayan too. The third career is a photographer. I've taken some good pictures, won some good prizes. A fourth career would be writing. How do I begin Washington? I tell the story that happened very shortly, 81 years ago, of my pigeon haben. My pigeon haben, my Zayda brought a big rav from one of the shuls on Washington Avenue, the Beis Medrash HaGadol, Rav Yaakov Meskin. Rav Yaakov Meskin was a Yerupeish Talmud Chacham. He was the one who wrote the tshuva to be Matir the Agunot. What was the boat, the greatest boat in the world that was launched a little over 100 years ago? The Titanic, right or wrong? Insinkable. Nothing could harm it. Had a kosher kitchen aboard. Kosher dishes, everything, highest standard of kashrut. Millionaires got on that boat for the maiden voyage, including very fine Jews. And you all know what happened. Well, if you don't come up with bodies, the women are called agunot, right or wrong? Agunah, have you studied agunah, agunot? It's Perek Yud Zayin in Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra. The last two prakim in Masechet Yevamot. Agunot? Can't remarry. Rav Meskin wrote the tshuva to be matir the agunot of the Titanic. Those were his tshuva. He was matir all the agunot. I can't go into it now. I've written about it on the basis of double doubt. It was a heter that was later quoted with the Twin Towers. When they had to be matir the agunot in the Twin Towers, they all quoted Rav Meskin's writings. So my grandfather brought Rav Meskin to redeem me. He was a Kohen, a Rav Yaakov, a Kohen Meskin. And all his life, my grandfather, Yetzdaf Echred in Yiddish, had geburchit. Simon, can you translate that into English? Jack, can you help me? My grandfather always expressed his displeasure, his dismay, that he brought Rav Meskin to redeem me. And after the pigeon, instead of staying for the meal, he ran away. Okay, and I read what I write about, that Rav Meskin was lacking a little bit prophecy, a little bit bitachon. Little did he dream that one day that little goyish-looking kid, surrounded by aunts and uncles who were assimilating quicker than you can say Jack Robinson, that little kid would one day teach his great-grandchildren in Yerushalayim, and that his granddaughter-in-law would be the partner, the legal partner of that kid's daughter. My daughter and his granddaughter-in-law have been partners for on to 30 years now. And little did he dream that I would interact with many members of the family. Why am I telling you this? Because one of the pictures that survived is Rabbi Meskin marching with the Rabbanim with his two sons, Chaim Yehoshua and Eliezer. There they are, marching with the Rabbanim. So Baruch Hashem, I have an indirect share in the march that took place.
Did you ever meet him later in life?
Rabbi Meskin? Yeah, as a kid I remember. He died, if I'm not mistaken, in the 50s. So I cannot say I was old enough to talk with him. But he was one of the Chashuva Rabbanim in the Bronx. Who didn't know Washington Avenue? One shul after another. All right. The story of the march not being received, but what it did lead to was the War Refugee Board. This War Refugee Board, organized by the State Department, organized by the President of the United States, organized in 1944, it played a big role in saving Jews in Romania and Hungary. And here, let me tell you another personal story and put it together with a very sad story. Sitting in this room now are a couple whose married name is Pianka. It's the husband and wife. They come from a little Jewish city called Hollywood, Florida. It's not North Miami Beach. That's where Vic is, if he hasn't left yet, for Boca with his sister. In North Miami Beach, in Hollywood, Florida, they picked up a family from Woodmere that answers to the last name of Gluck, G-L-U-C-K. The Glucks are Ivan and Phyllis. Ivan is one of four brothers. His mother and father and the three older brothers were all born in Hungary. They were saved by Raoul Wallenberg. When you talk about Wallenberg and the Jews he saved, they actually ran away to Budapest and were able to get into a safe house that was part of what was Wallenberg Swedish? What was he from? It was part of the Swedish domain. So the Nazis were not allowed to enter. You should know that the last day of the war, when the Russians were approaching, the Nazis realized all is lost, didn't give a damn about anything, and decided to try and kill every last Jew, and broke in to the embassy, and lined the Jews up, and they killed the first Jew. They're ready to shoot the one next to him. At that moment, the Russian soldiers came in. The Russians killed every German in sight. That's why the Germans prayed that they should be conquered by the Americans, because the Americans were nice, like we are. We're fools at times. These are killers. These are your enemy. No, but the Russians, everyone in sight, and that spared Ivan Gluck. Now, Raoul Wallenberg, who saved so many, what happened to him? What happened to him? Until today, we have no definitive answer. We have a theory. Theory seems to be correct, but it's only a theory. You see, how did he save all these Jews? Part of it was, of course, the Swedish government. Part of it was his own good heart. But part of it was the American government, was the Refugee War Board, was what we just spoke about. Part of it was money invested, enabling him to buy these buildings, declare them neutral, declare them part of Sweden. And we'll never know for sure, but there were all types of rumors, theories, that he was effectively what we would call today a CIA agent. When the Russians conquered the area, they captured everyone there, including Wallenberg. They took him to Moscow. We don't know for sure when, but the most plausible theory is he was executed in a Russian prison in 1947 approximately. We have contradictory reports. People claim they saw him in a Russian prison in 46 and 47, 48, 49. Others claim they know when he was executed. Until today, we have no body, We have no grave. But why did the Russians execute him? Because they felt he was an American spy. They felt that he worked for America. They felt that he not only saved Jews, but he was spying on the Russians and spying on them when they came into Hungary. He was part of the Cold War. And we have no real trace of what happened to Wallenberg. Contradictory testimony. And even after the communist empire fell, and so much became clear, we still can't give a definitive story what happened to Wallenberg. What we do have are streets named after him in Israel, in many cities in Israel. Chassidu Matolam, the man's name is perpetuated, revered, and so many Jews are walking the face of the earth, including an entire family with children and grandchildren, and part of that family lives in Hollywood, Florida. You have more to the family, because there's another brother, Jackie, who lives in Bal Harbor, but has a daughter that lives right near the Young Israel of Hollywood. So we have to bow our heads when we recall his memory, but we have to thank Senator Barber, we have to thank Secretary Morgenthau. Something did happen because of the march. We didn't save hundreds of thousands, but we did save thousands upon thousands. Hungary and Romania, where Hitler acted later. There was time to act there. Poland was gone. Lithuania was gone. White Russia was gone. The Ukraine was gone. But this part of Europe, Hitler only reached, as you know, in 44. So some good came out of it. I'll tell a story about the Gluck family. I'm sure they won't mind. And it comes back to what we said a moment ago, an hour ago, about the swing to the right. What did I mention to you? There were three children born in Hungary. They come to America, greenhorns after the war, displaced persons. And they start all over again. They have a fourth son. Four sons now. So you come to America. Your parents had money to send you to school. Where is an immigrant penniless? Remember, it's before reparations, before anything can be established. How are you going to have money to pay for the kids to go to school? So a yeshiva called RJJ. You've heard about that yeshiva, Shimmy? You've heard about it? Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. Used to be on the Lower East Side. Go back to Rakepit's lectures. The second yeshiva in the United States is in Staten Island today. And they took the refugee children in for nothing. The yeshiva was in Yiddish, obviously, at that time. And the older two Gluck boys go to Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yaakov Yosef. Well, by the time the third boy has to go to school, the father has started up in business again. He's doing a little bit better. And he goes to Charlie's and yours truly's alma mater, Talmudical Academy. All right, that's Jackie. Goes to TA. The fourth brother, Bobby, born in America, now the father is doing well, import-export business. He goes to the fanciest day school in the United States. Give me the name.
Ramaz.
Now I want to ask you, the two older brothers went to RJJ, the third brother went to MTA, the fourth brother went to Ramaz. You've heard of Ramaz? You've heard of Ramaz? Okay, Baruch Hashem. Out of the four brothers, only one wears a black hat when he davens. Can you give me the name of which brother? The Ramaz graduate, at the underline, the Ramaz graduate, that's the black hat. I've been privileged to teach children from all four families. Baruch Hashem. Okay. Now, I want to show you something else that's so sad. And this too, it haunts when you think of it. See, no one knew what was going on in Europe. By 1944, there was a much closer cooperation with the State Department. You knew who you couldn't turn to, you know who you could turn to. And here, I found the telegram to the State Department in the Silva Archives, a copy of the telegram. And here, we must appeal at the last moments for European Jewry. And in this telegram, they're asking the State Department to intervene for two great rabbis. And in the telegram mentions the names, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman and Rabbi Avraham Krajensky, the Mashkiach. We spoke about him, I believe, last week, the Mashkiach of Slabodka, and Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, the Brunovich of Rosh Yeshiva, pleading, intervene for them. No? Were they alive in 44? They were killed in 42. We have exact dates, actually, when that Aktion happened in Kovna. And could you imagine, they're sending telegrams, they're pleading with the State Department, and these rabbis are no longer alive. Acharei Mot, we move a little further. Agudas HaRabbanim, Far Hatzalah, Reb Lezer Silva, the war is over. All of you know, Yomo went back to Russia to celebrate the anniversary of the end of the war. It's one of the most patriotic days in communist Russia. Am I right or wrong, Yomo? Posters up all over the streets, and you got to give the Russians credit. They really fought a tremendous battle. You have no idea. You read about the Battle of Leningrad, the Siege of Leningrad. I knew Jews from Leningrad who suffered stomach ailments to the end of their lives. Even when they came in Aliyah, they could never get rid of the ailments because for how many days? Hundreds of days, they had no real food. The siege, and they withstood the siege. The Nazis never conquered Leningrad. They never conquered Moscow. The winter of 42, what went on, the siege of Moscow. And you got to give the Russians all the credit in the world. America alone would have never won World War II without the ability of the Russians to withstand the Nazi onslaught. They lost millions and millions and millions. Let it be said about the Nazis, had they not wasted their efforts in killing millions of Jews, that took away so much manpower and so much of their war ability and money, who knows what the outcome would have been. So there were certain factors there that created a miracle, the miracle of the Allied victory. Shimi, where were you in 45? Rafi, where were you in 45? What was going on in Europe? Where do you turn to the Jews? The Jews are all over. Where are they surviving? They just think for a moment. You've gone through a tremendous trauma, a tremendous tragedy. You've survived. No, some Jew concentration camps, this type of camp. They're in houses. No one knew where the Jews. How do we begin? How do we start? How do we act? How do we reach them? How do we talk to them? Not only that. Imagine you're uprooted. Denver, Colorado. Family still live in Denver? They moved to the East Coast. Imagine you're uprooted. Where do you go back? Where do you turn to? Where do you go home? People come in Aliyah and they save up money. When we came in Aliyah, it's a much, much, much poorer country 40, 50 years ago. When Malka and I came, we figured we'll never see America, and who will ever have money to travel? There was a travel tax there. Charlie, remember the travel tax? It's in your time yet, right? It's not ancient history. I don't. When did they abolish it? In the 80s? I forget already. It's a tramp. Remember what you had to go through with the army to get out of the country? Today it's a different ballpark. You try to go home. You go home. No? Can you really go home again? 20, 30, 40 years later, Malk and I went back to Maplewood. We didn't recognize the streets. We could swear that Chancellor and Lyons Avenue were interchanged. We knew these streets inside out. We lived there 62 to 69, 7 years. Bani Shalom, we came back 40 plus years later. We didn't recognize the streets. Our children grew up on. What are we talking about? What do you do when you're caught? What do you do? How do you reestablish yourself? I speak Polish. I speak Hungarian. I speak Russian. I want to go home. Where are my relatives? Where's my family? You got to remember, we're living in a different world today. Today, you're living in a world with computerization. You know what that means? You can draw up a list on the computer of every Jew that survived. And match them up, Jew with Jew, family with family. After World War II, the Red Cross had a list. The Hayas had a list. The Jewish Agency had a list. The Bialystoku Men's Club had a list. You understand what I'm saying? How do you find each other? Helter skelter, pandemonium. What a mix-up. Where do you turn? Rafi, where do you turn? And I have to say, once again, by the way, there was no easy solution to this. And you know that until today, particularly around Yom HaShoah, stories are published in every Israeli newspaper, on the TV, on every channel, of families finding families, cousins finding cousins. At one time, it was brother finding brother, sister finding sister. People turned up how many years later? But you disappeared, you went here, she went there. Go and find each other. How did you begin? Okay. At this point, Rabbi Leizer Silver realized immediately in 1945 the Var Hatzalah has to send people to Europe to survey the situation and make a decision. What do we do for them? And here I want to mention the first four famous Jews who were sent to Europe to try to figure out La'an. I'm paraphrasing a very famous Haskalah book written by a young man who died at the age of 24, his most famous work, Friedenberg, written early 1900s, late 1800s, La'an. Where do we turn? What do we do? The first person sent was all part of a delegation, but they split up. Rabbi Dr. Isaac Lewin. Recognize the name? Who's the famous Jewish lawyer? Not the one they quoted on the radio. I heard the news at 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock this morning, and then I go to shul and I got by a Sam Dershowitz and I say the most famous name on the radio this morning. Did you hear 4 or 5 o'clock news? Dershowitz. It's cousin Alan Dershowitz speaking about the President of the United States who's in big trouble with Russia. Boy, what goes on? I still haven't figured out how Russia can intervene in an election. What does that mean? They intervene in the ballots? That, like, it's a crime. But if I intervene and Russia announces, we would like Trump to become President of the United States, I think it would backfire. I don't know. Maybe I don't understand what's going on. But okay. So, man sein gesund. Nat Lewin's father was Rabbi Dr. Isaac Lewin. He was a member of the Bernard Revel Graduate School faculty. He was a great expert in response to literature, particularly from the Polish Rabbanim. He descended from the greatest Polish Rabbanim. His great-grandfather or his grandfather was Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes, the Lemberger Rav, the Beit Yitzchak. His father was the Reisha Rav. And Dr. Lewin, wow, what a personality. And who knew Poland better than Dr. Lewin? Who spoke Polish better? So he was principal of Central Yeshiva High School for Girls in your time, in my time. This is the Dr. Lewin we're talking about. He was part of the committee. Then there's a rabbinic family from YU, Vogelanta. You've all heard the name Vogelanta. But we're going back to the grandparents, the great-grandparents of the Vogelantas of today, Rabbi Solomon Vogelanta of Seattle, Washington. He was a tremendous activist, and he was involved in Hatzalah work. It's an older brother to Pinchas, an older brother to Rav Itamar. Later he comes in Aliyah and he changes his name to Itamar. He's a secretary to the chief rabbinate. He was Vogelanta, a younger brother of this Solomon Pinchas Vogelanta. I'm trying to think of his first name. I have a letter. I just gave my grandson a letter from him, because my grandson wants me to Sadeh Kedushin, and he's going to the Motzah Datit in Haifa. And I said they probably don't know me in Haifa. I was Masada Kedushin there, but it's in the early 70s. It's years ago. And I gave my grandson the letter from Chief Rabbi Unterman's secretary, Rav Itamar, that I don't want to quote the letter. It's a very nice letter, and I have the right to be Masada Kedushin all over Israel. So just yesterday, I held the letter in my hand, and it's the original letter. What happened was, when my grandson, Roy, went to the Motzah Datit in Yerushalayim, Rabbi Raubach, who knows me, got so excited, you're Rav Rakefet's grandson, he gave me the original letter. He Xeroxed it. He said, I'll keep the Xerox in the file, but this is the original letter on the chief rabbinate stationery with the signature. So Rav Itamar, this was his older brother. I can tell you, I'll tell you how else you'll know the family. Who is the big lady professor at Bar Ilan, who's a big feminist? Professor Tamar Ross. Recognize the name or not? Yomo good, so the Rebbe's not making it up. Professor Tamar Ross is a Vogelanta Itamar from the house. Her father and mother were Rav Vogelanta, who later become Rav Itamar in Israel. He was the second person sent. The third person was a name that we've spoken about, Zerach Mahavtik, Rabbi Dr. Zerach Mahavtik, Lithuanian yeshiva boy, Mizrahi leader, who was involved in the Shanghai episode and got to Japan and gets to the United States. He, Lithuanian, Russian, he knows that whole area. He is sent. Later, he comes back to America. He's part of the Israeli delegation to the UN in 47, 48, but 45, 46, he's back in Europe surveying what's going on, leading what's going on. And finally, the fourth member, we mention him with awe, our dear friend, Dr. Samuel Schmidt, Shmuel Schmidt, from Cincinnati, the follower, devotee, editor of the Friday newspaper in Cincinnati, the Jewish newspaper, every Friday it was called, the follower of Reb Lazer Silva, Reb Shmuel Schmidt, with his wonderful wife, who once again lets her husband go, and he's going to spend many, many months there. And finally, let me end off the class, whetting your appetite. These four go. Start to bring back the initial report or reports. And remember, these are DPs. They're all over. Some of you, where were your parents at this time?
Well, here.
Father was in Shanghai, so he went from there to America. Murray, your parents?
They left Palestine in 1939.
Aha, so you're from Palestine.
Made it to Williamsburg.
But there's Lenny, your parents?
They were American.
They were born in America. Dale, your parents?
Yeah.
Born in America. Jack, your parents?
Born in Poland.
But where were they in 46, 45?
In Iran.
Oh, they were in Toronto already. And all right, then I can't ask Charlie, because they were already in Washington Heights, right? Before the war. No? When did they get there?
Just before
the war. Okay. But, wow. And so Reb Lazer Silva, and he's no youngster, right? Reb Lazer now, figure out, he's in his 60s. Reb Lazer decides he is going to Europe. And by now he has the reports, he knows what he wants to do, and he's going as president of the Bar Hatzala, president of the Agudas HaRabbanim, and one condition. If he's going to go, he wants $100,000 in cash to distribute. That's his condition. A fortune of money. Fortune of money. Does he get it? Where does he keep it? How does he distribute it? Be'ezrat Hashem next week.
Why wasn't he robbed?
What? 1 second.
I always wondered why he was never robbed.
No, he was never robbed. I'll tell you why next week. You'll understand next week. Do me a favor. I have to make a class list. Just write the names and your email. But you got to be prepared in case anything happens that you have to cancel class. I want to be able to reach everyone. Okay, to reiterate... Etty, good to see you. Good to see you. Who's here from your family now?
My sister and brother-in-law are here for 2 weeks.
Who? Which ones?
Leah and Maya
Tempa. Okay. Got it.
So,
I understand. You were running around with them. That's part of the tourists.
They're leaving today.
Will you bench Gaimel or will you be sad? Which is it?
Sad.
Sad. Sad. Okay.
But I'm happy to come back to your class.
Okay. Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. My dear students, and to those listening as well, what did we do today? Vasamenga Tonheim. All right, the march is really a crucial moment. It's amazing. Certain things happen, and in retrospect, it was a watershed. A watershed, the great influence of Rav Soloveitchik. You can't minimize what became with that man, with my Rebbe afterwards. The Kol Dodido fake could have never been authored by the Rav without the 43 experience, in my humble opinion. And the Kol Dodido fake, that's a life-changing essay. If you understand it, you're not the same person again, plain and simple. There's many an Anglo who came in Aliyah, when you ask him, you scratch the surface, why did you come? They'll say, Kol Dodido fake. Can't argue with it. So, and also, it did bring about some positive results in this practical sense, because the War Refugee Board was basically a direct result of what happened with Roosevelt and the rejection and the few people who cared. And Senator Barber, whose name is not even mentioned anymore, he was one of the key people afterwards.
Which state was he from?
I think he was from Jersey, but it has to be checked. Maybe someone can go on their computer and check it. And I often wondered about that, because they don't identify him in the little cook.
They just talk about
Senator Taft. Senator Taft was the Blazer Silver's man. We spoke about him. But this was someone else, and he played a big role. And Henry Morgan thought, it cannot be underestimated what Rabbi Kalmanovich accomplished reaching his soul. It's like a Chabad concept of getting rid of the klipot and reaching the soul. And we bring it to the end of World War II, and we're now the Var Hatzala, but a different period, Reconstruction. And we'll see what happens. It's also very, very fascinating. Here I want to show you something, what surfaces today. You see what this is? It's an aerogram, an air letter. No one knows anymore, because today everything is the email. We don't even use faxes. So here's an aerogram written in Hebrew. Israel, Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, Joseph Soloveitchik, Tan Hancock Road, Brookline, Massachusetts. stamped Boston, January 28, 1969. It's a letter to Rav Yitzchak Nissim. Here's, this is the Rav's handwriting, that's his signature. It's a letter to Rav Yitzchak Nissim, to his chief rabbi of Israel. If I put it together, it's very simple. Rabbi Nissim visited America right after the Six-Day War. And he gave hell and fury to the Jews to come in Aliyah. Evidently, Rav Soloveitchik promised him he's going to come visit. Rabbi Nissim evidently wrote to him, Harishon Letzion, Harav Harashim, Malatuk Baldo, Harav Rav Yitzchak Nissim, Misrav Harishon Letzion, Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael. Well, no address, but it reached him. Evidently, he wrote to the Rav again, where are you? Why haven't you come? And the Rav writes him back a letter, essentially, I'd only use a coarse word, but it's double talk. Nebuch, he lost his wife, he's still in mourning, and he writes back, if he feels better, he will come, and he does want to come, but right now, his state of mind doesn't allow it. It's in beautiful rabbinic Hebrew, which not many people are able to read. I take a day to work out. But if anyone wants a copy, I made two copies of the letter. You're welcome to it. I promised a special gift to Shimi and Rafi. I'm not willing to give it to the rest of the class yet. I will deal with it when my new book comes out. I will deal with this. But, gentlemen, have you ever gotten a gift that's worth $1 billion? Do you understand what I'm giving you or not?
$1 billion.
More than $1 billion. You can't put a price on it. You see that handwriting? That's the Rav. But I'm taking mercy on you because you're going to have trouble reading it. Here's the letter written out in TypeScript that anyone from Frisch or elsewhere can read. And this answers the question you asked me a number of weeks ago, but I'm going to answer it big with a capital B when my new book comes out. Pass this on to those two fine young men. And one second, and Simon, who's become my right hand, although I have to tell you, Sherry sent me an email that came in today that sent me up to heaven. Believe it or not, people are listening to me. Believe it or not, I may yet change part of the world. You can't believe the email I got. She sent it to me. She bypassed everyone because she realized what it meant to me. Simon, this is your tip for bringing these two buccaneers to class. Now the freebies, wait a minute. You don't know what's going on in New York City. They're very serious. They're cracking down on the yeshivas. Yeshivas could lose state funding for poor education. It seems now what Simcha Feder did, you see, sometimes you can't be overly wise. Murray, he got a law passed that learning Gemara is more important than mathematics or English. So the New York State Education Committee woke up that yeshivas are training kids to be morons outside of Torah. If you know Torah, it doesn't mean you know mathematics, science. It doesn't mean you understand the importance of taking a measles vaccine. So here's the headline. Yeshivas could lose state funding for poor education. You won't believe this. This poor Rabbi Zev Lev learning Gemara at the soccer game in Scotland. This has now become a cause célèbre. And I have a letter today, which I have to go through. I think they're criticizing him for wasting his time going to a soccer game. And I just got an 81st birthday gift from a dear students of mine. It is a link to the seventh game of the 1952 World Series. And in the letter they say, Rebbe, we know you don't have 3 hours, but maybe you can squeeze out 3 hours to be a kid again. So I wrote back to them, I will watch it 6 times 1 half hour. Follow me? 6 nights, a half hour when I'm dead tired. Then I will watch. This is a beautiful picture, what surfaces on the internet, the dedication of Chevron Yeshiva, sitting right in the center is Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. This is from Rehov Yeshiva in the center of Jerusalem. It would be great if there'd be anyone alive who could identify who is in this picture. American thinker, the future of American Jewry is Orthodox by Martin Ingal. I don't like the word Orthodox, let me use the word. The future of American Jewry is returning to Jewish living observance. But there's one paragraph here that I love. So much of liberalism is at odds with traditional Judaism, it's hard to know where to start. Moral relativism, multiculturalism, rejection of religion, globalism, elevation of the group over the individual, exchange of God-given rights for government-conferred rights, inversion of private property, casting aside the preciousness of every soul. And wow, that's exactly our problem. We are Jews, not liberals. Trouble for yeshiva. Here's the article, more details. Under the new rules, they're going to have 3 years to spruce up their programs, and all the schools are going to be investigated. It seems in the past, yeshiva would not allow people in from the Board of Education to investigate the level they are teaching and what they are teaching. This is a review of the volumes by the great Dr. Arnold Lustiger on the Rav, the OU Chumashim. It's a review of his work on the Rav on Chumash. It's a good job. Yeah, people, again, it doesn't have everything, and Yitzhak's upset it's missing on the Saturday. We don't have access to it. But it's a very good job. Arnold Lustiger is very capable. I love him. He's very capable. He's an amazing guy. He never studied with the Rav. He comes from the right-wing world, educated in Neir Yisrael. He educated his kids right-wing, but he heard the Rav speak once, and it changed his whole life. And he has a very important job with an ESO. I mean, he's a genius, a PhD in some form of chemistry, which they need. Okay. That's what he works there. I think he works for... That's Arnold Lustiger. This is about the Pinchas of the Vilna Gaon's Cloys, which is now on display at YIVO in New York. With if anyone, again, you have to... There's no end to what's surfacing, and they can put it online and make it available to the whole world. Here I have two copies were sent to me, or printed out for me. Are Jared and Ivanka good for the Jews? See, we Jews, even when we have a Kiddush Hashem, a couple like Jared and Ivanka, and here they are with Chief Rabbi Lau and Yad Vashem, so we have to find fault. You follow me? Like morons. Good for the Jews, bad for the Jews. What can be bad for the Jews? A couple of Hashem and Shabbos. And New York Times, who wrote it? Tell the Yomo, tell them.
Amy and Hannah Seligson. Oh, Amy Chodzik and Hannah Seligson.
And Charlie, for you, I can't escape Mrs. Shulamit Berchafa. Who are they talking about? A relation. Okay. 1 second. Oh, okay. That is it. I've given out all the goodies. I have to deal, Simon, we have to deal with each other until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Bedanya. Jack? I have it.
I hope you enjoy them.
Oh, yes.
Mashallah Khair. It's not what I did for you last year.
No, I'm just saying they're good.
But I wore these last week, a pair of similar.
Good, good. Good. They're in the apartment already. It's not that. What comes in, I take out. I have
an auxiliary library here.
This is up for auction. Yeah, you can kill it.
You can turn it off.
Any questions?